The following program has been brought to you by Rolling Press, a family-run, eco-friendly printing company. For more information, visit rollingpress.com. You're listening to heritageradionetwork.org, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station. We're millions strong, with folks tuning in from over 200 countries. We are education. We are entertainment. We are the future of food. May is our membership drive. Become a member and support us while receiving e-newsletters, advanced invites, special discounts, and a membership card. We need your support. Visit our website and click the donate button to become a member today. Thank you for believing in us, and enjoy the show.
Episode
72
of The Morning After. I'm Jesse Kiefer.
I'm Jen Tulloch. How are you, Jesse?
I'm doing well. I never understand why the L train shuts itself down on holiday weekends. Traveling from the East Village doesn't really work
and
so
the
well.
Fact that they keep it running in Brooklyn is almost just a slap in the face. It's like, oh, fabulous. Well, if I need to go to Livonia, that's the train for me.
Canarsie, however you want to go.
Not that we hate on any of those neighborhoods. We send them mad love. But I have to admit, I lucked out because I live further into Bushwick, so I was able to take the L train today. So I'm sorry about your arduous journey.
Well, I got some sun. That's always a good thing.
Jessie actually had to rent a pack mule to get here. She left yesterday. She survived on a crude little bag of dry oats and cranberries.
Well, I'm really lucky. I had a pretty sustaining meal last night,
did you?
Yeah, so the pack meal was okay, actually.
What did you have to eat?
I for the first time, I had dinner at Prune. I've been for brunch, and I've been for lunch.
Gabrielle.
Well, I'm kind of doing my research. I'm reading the book. I had dinner. I had a great dinner, so.
What did you have?
I had we had soft shell crab, we had head on prawns, just really fresh peas and asparagus.
Sounds very clean and springy.
Very clean, springy, and simple. Delicious bottle of Assyrtiko. It was fantastic.
That sounds lovely. So, I've only been there for brunch and I had a great time. I went with my mother and future mother-in-law, so it was an estrogen fest.
Did you drink?
Oh, did I drink? Didn't we all?
Well, speaking of drinking, did you know that today is World Sherry Day? Which is incredibly exciting. Fest for me, although I think this is the first installation of it, so I'm excited to see how that goes. So in honor of World Sherry Day, we have kind of one of the foremost dudes on sherry, Peter Leem.
Dudes on Sherry, which is the name of our restaurant we're about to open.
D-O-O-D-S.
Yes.
Dudes on Sherry. Welcome to the studio, Peter.
Thank you, Jeff. Jesse.
I can't wait to talk to you about what you've done with Sherry Fest in October, and I know you did it in March as well, like a West Coast edition.
We did, yes, in Portland, Oregon.
So I cannot wait to hear all about that. Also, we're going to check in with our friend Tova Danovich from
Food Politic.
Well, I put the P in the world, front of the F. I really was trying to say foodpolitic.com, but in reality, it's foodpolitic.com. It's a food news and culture journal online.
Which I now read weekly. Truth. Oh, yeah. Are you kidding me?
No.
Ever since we had her on the show, I'm a huge fan. I'm really pumped to check in with her and see what crazy stories she has from the week.
Did you see the Athenos Feta Yaya commercials?
No. Go on.
There's this woman whose name is Chef Jessica, and she's making all these delicious dishes with feta cheese, Athenos Feta cheese, and her Yaya is with her, which I think is the name for grandma.
Yes.
Or is what you call your grandma if you're Greek. And Yaya is very much like the Yaya in My Big Fat Greek Wedding, where she's just still in the war. She's wearing her, you know, her scarf around her head. She's breaking things with rocks and bringing in goats. So it was kind of fun. And I checked that out on foodpolitic.com. I recommend everybody checking that out as well. We also are going to have a little what's on the menu at Chardonnay's later in the show. But first, the elephant in the room.
It must be discussed.
Is the great Guga Muga.
Oh, the great, the bad, the ugly, the beautiful, the over, the canceled.
I mean, I feel slightly cursed. The Guga Muga curse. And I hate to say that because the people involved are, you know, wonderful people, have been so great and supportive with us. But, you know, day two canceled because of the rain. It's, you know, and last year there was a lot of problems. How do they come back?
On the list of things that could have gone wrong, not only was everything crossed off with the list, then self-combusted and blew away to the air. It was like a Ritz Brothers routine at a certain point. It was just like, well, you know, they had the elements against them, the natural elements, of course, which is no one's fault. And once that, you know, is a factor, there's so little you can do to sort of scramble and fix it. But again, all of the people, we have to say before we proceed, the people that were involved that we dealt with were lovely and accommodating and super professional. But unfortunately, the Mother Nature was against the Googs this year.
Mother Nature's been against New York this year.
Yeah.
Unless
apparently
year.
So.
So we decided to kind of tell our story about Googa Mooga in a front of house sort of way.
It's your favorite story. It's front of house. It's a front of house.
What a jingle.
Front of house is our segment where we relive the mistakes and wild tales as members of the front of house. This is as members of the restaurant journalist crew.
It is. And, you know, there was something about the tenor of this story that made me feel that we've had a varied list of guests that have come in and read our segments for us. Bjork was lovely enough to be here 1 week. We, of course, often feature the Dame Joan Plowright, the Baroness Olivier.
Queen Latifah.
Queen Latifah was with us 1 week. This week I've actually called on a friend of mine, a gal from Brooklyn named Estelle Van Buren, who's a neighbor of mine, to detail our story. Estelle?
We should have known that this was coming. My co-host and I woke up bright and early. We left our respective homes in Bushwick and the East Village and serendipitously ran into each other on the train platform. What a surprise. Giddy from sleep deprivation and the prospect of a full day of food, booze, and reporting, we filed on to the Q train, destination the Great Googa Mooga. We took our seats and I began to scan the subway car, checking for hot ladies, creeps, vomit, or scary adolescents. When my eyes stopped on this very old man dressed in a navy suit with a maroon turtleneck. My first three husbands loved a maroon turtleneck. His suit coat was placed neatly on his lap so as not to wrinkle while he was sitting down. How pleasant, I thought. This man in his 80s still likes to dress up when he rides the subway. As we entered the tunnel between Brooklyn and Manhattan, we noticed his shiny loafers almost tap dancing on the dingy floor. I think that's meant to be read as dingy, but I don't have on my spectacles. Of the Q train. We raised our eyes and realized his left hand moving vigorously underneath his strategically placed suit jacket. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my Jesus God, holy God, my co-host and I, transfixed and horrified, were looking like a Twitter picture of Amanda Bynes. People got on, and as he continued to get off, jerking and shaking along with the movement of the train. How did no one else notice this? Were they blind? We were alone in our disgust. When we finally arrived at our Prospect Park stop, we were shells of the people we used to be. I was shaking. My co-host was sweating. He is the reason we should have known this was coming. We got ourselves to the park grounds, and the sky seemed to darken. Up until this day, the weather forecast said it would be a sunny weekend. We tried to regroup. We had a beer, got some great interviews. Snuck behind the line with Jeepney and M. Wells. Lovely people. Asked Eddie Hung.
Huang.
What's... His name is Eddie, is the point. We asked him what was on the Chinese menu at Chardonnay's. We sipped some cocktails while talking to the Julie Ryder of Clover Club. Got an exclusive on Amanda Freitag's new restaurant, Mazel Tov, Amanda. In the old diner space. Beautiful. So what if it was raining? We were on a roll. And screw you, old dirty guy. When day two of the festival was canceled, it was time to look back on all of the great audio we collected. We were very excited. But to our dismay, none of it was recorded correctly. Nothing. Silch. Zippo. Sinky. Zero. I think the old man was an omen. He's the reason we were left empty-handed, if you will. Thank you so much. I gotta go. I got a back order of about 16 episodes of Lawrence Welk Show on my DVR. Gotta run. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Estelle. It was a really sad thing to find out, and I swear, he's the reason. He darkened it all. He cursed the Googa Mooga.
That embarrassing act really did herald the rest of the day. It just like trumpeted in a day of oopsies.
Serious blunders, serious front of house
moment. It was a front of house, the best edition.
And I honestly hope we never relive it.
And we never will. But we're about to live something else, girl.
We are. We're going to take a break. Going to regroup, get that story out of our minds. We're going to come back with Tova Danovich, foodpolitic.com. This is The Morning After. Back here on The Morning After. A few weeks or maybe a month ago, we had Tova Danovich.
Seems like yesterday.
Seems like just yesterday. Jen's been thinking about it. We had her on the show talking about her site, foodpolitic.com. It's a food news and culture journal online. Really awesome stuff on there. She's been featured on the Huffington Post, among other publications. Tova, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, girl.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. We're so excited to chat to you again. How are you?
I'm very well. Just spent an afternoon in Prospect Park, which is a great time for it, finally.
Yeah, much better than last Sunday.
Yes, exactly.
When the Googa Booga was going down.
Jesse and I were swimming through the sea of mud trying to talk to chefs. It was not a pretty sight. Does it look a little greener now?
It does, yeah. It's beautiful, green. People are out, although not too many, because I think a lot of people are out of town, so it's nice.
That's good to hear, because I have plans for Prospect Park Memorial Day barbecue tomorrow.
Oh!
Uh-huh. So, well, you might be in luck.
Well, because I hear you're supposed to, like, get by the barbecue. I don't actually never have had a barbecue in Prospect Park. They must have, like, grills there that you use.
They do.
So I hear you're supposed to kind of line up at, like, 7 a.m.
Oh, it's competitive.
And if you don't do that, yeah, you're screwed.
I don't know how you feel about firearms, but I would at least bring a slingshot.
How does Food Politic feel about firearms?
Ooh.
Oh, I don't know. We haven't tackled that one yet, but barbecue is definitely, I would say, pro-outdoor barbecuing.
Well, we just want to get sort of check in with you and find out what the hottest stories were from this week. Just, we've both become a fan of the site and think it's just so amazing. And we were wondering if you could give us sort of just a brief rundown of the best highlights from the week.
Yeah. Well, I would say one of them, which I think just got put up on Thursday or Friday, was one called Why I'm Not a Foodie.
I read that one.
Yeah, it's definitely turned into the most popular one of the last few days, and I think it's a subject that deserves more attention. It was kind of talked about a lot maybe a few years ago when people started really making fun of the foodie thing and how it was kind of played out, and then it just dropped off and foodie became, you know, the only word that people use to describe people interested in food. And it's just really not very representative of, I think, all of the variety of people that do things with food. So, you know, it definitely talks to the kind of Instagram your food set who wants to, as the author pointed out, I think, spend like $14 on duck liver taco or some crazy concoction like that. But really doesn't say anything about the people who, you know, want to really do something to change the way that food justice plays out in the world or, you know, who's getting access to what type of food. So that's been a piece that I think a lot of people have been reading. And then we've been doing a lot with multimedia in the last few weeks, which has been really great. bringing in a lot of different kind of mini documentaries with either short articles about or interviews with the people kind of behind it. And those have been really interesting, and I think a different way for people to really not just read about, but kind of visually get into what, you know, the politics might mean in a very kind of scenic way on occasion.
I was going to ask you, I got into a conversation with a family member this week, and this was over the internet, it should be said, but this is someone who I greatly respect and admire and loves to cook, but lives in the middle of the country. And she said to me, I just don't understand what people mean when they say food ethics. Like, what does that mean? How can food be ethical? And we got into a fruitful but sort of heated discussion about that, what that means. And I was wondering what you might say to her.
Yeah, I mean, it's very different, I think, to someone who lives in the country. It's much harder to kind of, I think, easily see the effects of this because, you know, in New York, you can maybe walk within a mile and kind of find a neighborhood where there is not as much food to choose from, where the produce is clearly bad, versus out in the country, you might have to drive for quite some time to, you know, come to the next grocery store that isn't just the one you're used to.
Right.
But food is just so, I think, intertwined in politics for everything like, you know, donating food to other countries or who has access to what food. You know, when you're donating food to a food bank, who gets that? How long after the donation are they getting it? Who's preparing it in what, you know, combination. And I think obviously in a very kind of easy to understand way, when you're eating well, you're healthier. Healthy people are more able to go to work. They have more energy. You know, you don't get sick as often. And just little things like that, that I think we can all relate to. You know, when you're eating a lot of junk food, you don't feel so good. You don't feel so good and you don't perform so well. And so on a very basic level, you know, the ethics of kind of starting everyone out on an equal footing just from breakfast on will make you kind of do better in your day and in your life.
It kind of makes me think of another thing I saw in Food Politic, which was, I believe the article was called like Fat Kids or something like that, where they're talking about how, you know, everyone's so concerned with cigarettes being kind of displayed and, you know, behind the counter. I mean, it really is kind of a display. But then right below the counter at kids' eye level is candy, is chocolate bars, is gum. I don't know. Have you had much response to that article?
Yeah, definitely. And that article is actually partially, it was co-written with one of our other editors, Zoe Mendelson, who's done some really great pieces on the site and brought in some really interesting points of view as well. I think that it's really difficult. I mean, even looking back to, you know, the soda lobbying efforts from a few months ago, people get really touchy about having their food regulated. In a way that I think we've kind of come to get used to smoking and alcohol. There's a certain age limit for it, so it's a little bit easier to kind of at least slightly put some of that stuff out of reach for people. But obviously in the same way that cigarette advertising had an impact on how many people and how young were getting addicted, food advertising has a huge impact. But it's incredibly hard to regulate between just food lobbies and, you know, parents who don't want to feel like government is meddling in something that should be their business. It's all about health, and it definitely, it's an impactful thing on how you grow up.
Also, yesterday was the, I believe it was an anti-Monsanto protest, right?
Yeah.
People were walking down the street yelling, hell no, GMO.
There's an app now, have you seen, that will let you scan your food product to tell you whether or not it has been produced by or endorsed by Monsanto, so you can you can boycott it, which is, I think, really cool. And, you know, going back to what you were saying about the word foodie and how it's, I think, in some circles become almost a scarlet letter. A couple friends, you know, on Facebook had posted an article about this app and said, oh, well, you know, you're a foodie, so here, you'll like this. And mm-hmm. I thought, well, that really isn't the point, is it? Like, I just don't want to eat genetically altered food. It's that simple.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's crazy. Do you guys have any plans on talking about that?
Yeah, I mean, we've done a few pieces on GMOs in the past. It's a huge, huge issue. I mean, constantly there's more coming up about it. You know, all these states are trying to kind of regulate labeling efforts. And then, you know, like you mentioned, the rally yesterday. It's really difficult, though, because the science is kind of somewhere in the middle. And I spent a lot of time looking into this about a year ago, because I think more than a lot of other subjects, for whatever reason, it's really heated around GMOs. People are not kind of, I guess, liberal or equal-minded on the subject. You either see, you know, pro-Monsanto organizations saying it's completely fine, we're changing the world, we're feeding, you know, starving everyone. And then you see these other people that say everything that they do is evil, these products are horrible, they're going to kill you, they're going to kill the environment. And it's really hard to take either side seriously with arguments like that. Whenever I see someone a little bit too impassioned, I'm inclined to take a step back and, you know, wonder who's really telling the truth. And as best I could tell from what I was reading, clearly there are a lot of unknowns with GMOs. We just don't have any idea over the long term what it's going to do to our health, to the planet, to a large extent, because it's so new and because the regulations have been so lax with kind of starting off where we're going to grow this and why and, you know, under what conditions. But the biggest problem really just seems to be that these companies kind of suck. Their business practices aren't good. And I think that it's more in the patenting area that you really come into problems with GMOs, where for, say, a public institution who would offer up a type of seed that's going to grow in, say, like completely dry weather conditions, they can't go through the same processes that one of these large like genetic engineering companies would go through, because those companies own the patents on, say, step A through C of the process. And it would cost this university so much money to do the research that they're unable to do that and kind of offer it up for free. And that, to me, is really where the kind of evil of the company that I've seen kind of comes up. And it's not something that people talk a lot about. I think it's a lot less kind of glamorous and flashy. But it's definitely something of a lot of importance in the genetic engineering debate.
Well, I can't wait to hear your conclusions on this and just as a journalist in general, I expect you to show both sides. And I
mm-hmm. and I think we both have such respect for what you do, because you do present it in such an impartial and clear-minded manner that that's why I've become such a fan of your site, because I think it's such a great library of resources without being preachy. It's so cool.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I'm glad we're succeeding.
Well, the website is foodpolitik.com. Thank you so much, Tova. We'll talk to you soon. Have a great day.
Great. Thank you both.
Bye, Tova. Bye.
We're going to come right back with Peter Leem. This is The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org.
You're listening to Written from the Pantheon by Iggy Dean on the heritageradionetwork.org. Keep it locked for The Morning After.
Today's program was brought to you by Rolling Press. Rolling Press is a family-run digital and offset print house that brings together eco-friendly methods, ethical practices, and personalized service. Using environmentally responsible papers, non-toxic inks, and wind power, Rolling Press represents the harmony of traditional craftsmanship and mindful sustainability. Rolling Press offers advice on reducing paper waste and energy consumption, helping you save money and minimize your carbon footprint. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
And we're back here on The Morning After. Today is World Sherry Day, and in studio is Peter Leem. He's a wine writer for numerous publications. He's the creator of ChampagneGuide.net, the author of Sherry, Manzanilla, and Montilla, and the co-founder of Sherry Fest. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, please, I know that you are not a part of World Sherry Day. How did that get started that you know of?
Well, World Sherry Day is the initiative of Wolfgang Hess, who is a great sherry lover, and he has a team of people working on it. I'm not involved, at all with this, but I'm certainly a supporter of it. And World Sherry Day, or the idea of World Sherry Day is that they are getting people across the world. I mean, I think they have participants in something like 28 countries. And getting people to host sherry themed events all over the world. Today. We're here in New York. We're having an event tonight at the Beagle in celebration of World Sherry Day. And I know there are a number of other people in the United States doing the same thing.
So you wrote the book on sherry. I mean, I know there's a much more massive book on sherry, but really you wrote the more current book on sherry.
It's true.
I think sherry is something that maybe 10 years ago no one was thinking about, or people were thinking about, but it wasn't this hot topic. Why now? Why is sherry all over the place?
Well, it's true. 10 years ago, there were certainly people here in the United States and elsewhere who did appreciate sherry, but it was a much more restricted community. I think it's been very gratifying to see this sort of explosion in sherry appreciation, occur over the space of a short time. I mean, really, the last 2 or 3 years. It's difficult to say, exactly why this has been so, but I think that this coincides with sort of a greater discovery of the wine world in general. Mm-hmm. It hasn't been just sherry, but a lot of other wine regions and wines that have been perhaps marginalized or forgotten about or whatever, that have sort of entered or re-entered the cultural consciousness, and sherry is a very visible one. It seems like here in New York, there's nothing cooler than sherry right now, and that's really exciting to see.
So, as the co-founder of Sherry Fest, has the sherry community in Jerez, have they seen kind of a surge in business or more people are bringing it in, is it still kind of the same as it's always been?
Well, I mean, I don't know about business numbers.
Sure.
I do think that there's more sherry being imported now than I've ever seen in my 20 years of drinking sherry. Certainly just, as far as the sherry community or as far as the people in the sherry region. One of my ideas with Sherry Fest was always to really show sherry producers and show these people what was going on in our country and specifically in New York.
Mm-hmm.
I think that New York is a tremendously exciting place to drink sherry. Arguably, one of the two best places in the world, along with London, and. And sometimes, when you're in Jerez, people are still a little bit pessimistic. It's, the sherry industry has been on the decline for a very long time. The industry is continuing to shrink. There isn't a lot of domestic demand for sherry. You know, it's ironic now that, you know, sherry is almost forgotten in its home country, and all of this energy that we're seeing around sherry is really happening abroad. And so, you know, for a lot of these producers that had never been to New York, they only really knew about sherry appreciation here sort of peripherally. Mm-hmm. And I wanted them to come here and really see it for themselves. And I think we succeeded in that. You know, that last year when we had our first Sherry Fest in October of 2012, it was an extremely successful event. Mm-hmm. And you know, and the people from the bodegas, I mean, they were talking about it, you know, to me for months afterwards, just, just telling me about all the people that they met here and you know, how enthusiastic people were. And they were really surprised also at the crowd itself, you know, mm-hmm. just being composed of largely younger people and really wine knowledgeable people and really inquisitive people. And I think all that was really great.
Is sherry production on the decline just because it's not a quick moneymaker, because it takes much more time to produce?
I think that probably plays into it. Mm-hmm. You know, sherry is certainly not inexpensive to create. Mm-hmm. Even though, you know, it sells for you know, what seems like absurdly cheap prices. But really, you know, for the last, I don't know, I suppose we could say 40 years, you know, sherry has just been so out of fashion. Mm-hmm. That's forced the industry to change in very significant ways, and you know, for a long time, you know, up until very recently, you know, there really was not a demand for sherry as a fine wine. You know, sherry was really regarded as something inexpensive, something to cook with, something that grandmothers drink. You know, mm-hmm. it wasn't being taken seriously as a wine, and all that is changing. But at the same time, you know, I'm not sure that the sherry industry is ever going to come back to the levels that it was in its heyday.
So you are the creator of ChampagneGuy.net. I know you live in Champagne for a good amount of the year. So why sherry? You know, like how did you come to that?
Yeah, I suppose you know, in my public persona, it seems sort of out of the blue. But in fact, I've been a fan of sherry for a very long time, for as long as I have been a fan of champagne. I was fortunate in that I was introduced to sherry quite early on in my wine drinking career, and so. The first time I ever went to the sherry country was in 1998. So, you know, I've been traveling there
old
for,
school.
Yeah. You know, I've been traveling there for 15 years. I've been drinking sherry longer than that. And it's always been you know, one of my great loves in the wine world. You know, particularly in recent years, I've been focusing very heavily on champagne. Mm-hmm. You know, a few years ago, I felt that it was time to have a new sherry book. I mean, there's the existing body of literature, you know, on sherry in English is actually quite vast, but most of it, you know, dates from the late 19th or early 20th centuries. The last entirely new sherry book to be published in this country was in 1988. So that was quite a while ago.
Yeah, is it still in publication?
No, and all of these things are out of print. Mm-hmm. And so all of them, you know, are really talking about a world that no longer exists. And so I thought that it was time for a new sherry book, and I wanted to be the one to write it. So I had this idea in my head that I would. You know, eventually, I was speaking with my friend Jesus Barquin, mm-hmm. Who is regarded as one of the great sherry experts alive today.
Creator of Equipo Navazos.
Yes, uh-huh. Yeah, founder of Equipo Navazos, and eventually we decided to do a collaboration mm-hmm. together, and so the result was this book.
I mean, I'm so happy that it exists and that it's here with us. What else is on the horizon for you at this moment? As you did Sherry Fest in Portland, you said.
Yeah, I mean, we're Sherry Fest is a collaboration between me and my friend Rosemary Gray. Mm-hmm. And we're very committed to keeping Sherry Fest going. I think that, you know, it's certainly not a one-off event. We're doing it again this year in New York, in fact. It will be October 5 to 8 in 2013. And we really would like to take Sherry Fest on the road in the future. This past spring, we experimented with a smaller version of Sherry Fest, mm-hmm. in Portland, Oregon. And that was very successful as well. It was great to see see the energy there and see so many people interested in Sherry. We would certainly like to do events in other cities in the future.
What is there anything that you did in Sherry Fest that you want to improve upon, or something like new ideas that you guys have come up with, or something that you're going to try that you didn't get to this year?
Well, I think, the general format is going to remain the same. Mm-hmm. As with last year, the centerpiece of the event is a large grand tasting.
Mm-hmm. That I did not get into.
Well, we'll have to fix that this year.
Yes.
Last year it was massive. It was fantastic. We had 20 bodegas participating. We were pouring 150 different sherries. And just having all of these sherries open in the room at one time, the smell in the room
I can
was
only
incredible.
Imagine.
That was an all day tasting, I've never heard of a larger sherry tasting.
Mm-hmm.
So we're certainly going to repeat that style of tasting again. Also, with Sherry Fest, it's a multi-day event,
mm-hmm.
and we do various seminars on topics, on various topics related to sherry, and we do dinners,
mm-hmm.
With representatives from bodegas. Pairing sherry with food is the very best way to experience the wine. I think what I would like to do this year is do more with food and wine,
mm-hmm.
and maybe like seminars involving parents and things like that.
I was able to make it to the Bar Jamón dinner with Javier Hidalgo, mm-hmm. and Felipe from González Pías, and mm-hmm. it was really cool. And I remember when I bought the tickets, my girlfriend Erin was like, isn't it going to get monotonous? Isn't it sherry and food, isn't there so much that you can do with it? And I felt the same way. I was like, I may get sick of it. I don't know how this is going to work. I mean, I know there are various different sherry profiles, but, is it still just going to feel like fortified wine? But, I was totally wrong, of course. Thank God. And it was incredible. So I would love to see more dinners like that. Absolutely. And just the close conversation that I got to have with these winemakers, people whose families have been in this business for eons, it seems like.
Yeah. Definitely.
So I love what you guys are doing. Are there any tickets available still at the Beagle for the World Sherry Day?
There are. Yes.
Party.
Yeah. Well, I was just speaking with the rest of the gang this morning, and we are going to be selling tickets at the door until they're sold out.
Awesome.
It's $49, and it's an open sherry bar.
Okay.
And we'll be pouring all sorts of things. So. So, yeah, I would definitely encourage people to come.
And it's at the Beagle, which is on Avenue A between 10th and 11th,
yes,
correct?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
It's a great spot. It's an awesome sherry bar. I remember I live in that neighborhood, so when I first checked out the bar, I looked at their sherry list, and I was like, holy shit, they have like 12 sherries by the glass.
Yeah, it's one of the best places in New York to drink sherry.
So I love that you guys are involved with the Beagle, obviously. That would happen. Where can we go get tickets? Also, or you're just going to do at the door?
Well, there are tickets available online,
mm-hmm.
at Eventbrite, but we will be selling tickets at the door. And,
okay.
And so I think today that's probably the easiest way to get them.
And where can people check out your book, Sherry Manzanilla and Motilla?
So the book is for sale on my website, which is sherryguide.net, It's also available at various wine stores here in New York, mm-hmm. Places like Crush and Chamber Street and Astor. Mm-hmm. You can also get it at Kitchen Arts and Letters. On the West Coast, you can get it at places like K&L Wine Merchants, Arlequin Wine Merchants in San Francisco, E&R Wines in Portland, Oregon. But really, the easiest way to get it is at sherryguide.net.
Great. Thank you so much for being on the show, Peter. And we'll definitely have to have you and Rosemary back when Sherry Fest times 2 happens.
We'd love to. Thanks all so right. much.
We are going to take a break. We're going to come back with what's on the menu at Chardonnay's. This is The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org.
You're listening to Election by Iggy Dean on the heritageradionetwork.org.
We are back here on The Morning After on Heritage Radio Network. I am afraid it is that time again every Sunday where we discover what bad food and wine trends of times past we're going to feature this week on What's on the Menu at Chardonnay's.
Ooh, uh-huh. What's on the menu at Chardonnay's?
Now, a frequent guest of ours is the Dame Joan Plowright, the Baroness Olivier, and I've missed her recently because she hasn't been by in the last couple of weeks to do our front of house segment. So I've actually flipped the switch. I flipped the program, and I've invited her to read our Chardonnay's menu because I think it might just be up her alley. Joe, may I have a bit of music, please?
Lords, ladies, dukes, duchesses, noble henchmen, dignitaries, and other various foreign extractions of high nobility, on behalf of Her Royal Grace, Duchess Viddington Hemworth of Sussex, welcome one and all to the Queen's Garden Tea. I do pray your journeys were without hindrance. It has long since been our belief that since its inaugural year in 1682, the Queen's... It seems that the Lady Edrington of Kent has folded her menu into a tiny paper aeroplane and is now flying it at my head. Ladies and gentlemen, Lady Edrington. I'm just opening the lady's message now, Nefarious Goat, and it does read as follows. Dearest Wilhelmina, no one here likes you, and almost certainly agree that your new haircut makes you look like Napoleon Bonaparte. Please do stop rambling on and let us eat. I hate you, I hate you, I hate you. I hope you die soon. Sincerely, Lady Edrington. Thank you, Lady Edrington, for such searing poetics. And now, without further ado, today's first course will feature buttered Yorkshires and cream and a wild pheasant roulade, followed immediately by a pimento and prawn sarnie. Lady Edrington, I will speak! Do sit down! If you insist upon tossing paper constructions at my head, I pray you allow me 2 brief minutes to detail the menu, which our underpaid kitchen staff have prepared in a filthy root cellar with no air circulation. Following the sarnies, there will be a soup of dill and potato, smoked pork sausages with blood pudding, and an onion puff topped with... Ladies and gentlemen, it has come to my attention that Lady Edrington has now removed her dress and is performing what seems to be some sort of erotic choreography for an understandably stunned Lord Brophy of York. If I may proceed, there is but a moment of my presentation left. The onion puff will be followed by a Bakewell custard with English crumpets and a champagne toast. It seems as though Lord Brophy has suffered a heart attack and is now receiving mouth-to-mouth resuscitation by a half-naked Lady Edrington. Enjoy your food, you load of incompetent fuckers. I'm going to chug some dessert wine and send a drunken telegram to my ex-husband. Thank you, and good day.
I think she went to go chug some Harvey's Bristol Cream Sherry.
Sherry. It was definitely Sherry. Sherry report. I don't know which.
Something. Oh, man. How does the dame deal with regular dinner parties like that?
You know what? I feel like when you're at that level of celebrity, it's just like breathing and eating.
I'm going to do some of that. Take a little break.
I would like us to, from henceforth and hitherto, sign off with you incompetent fuckers.
You incompetent fuckers. No, we want them to listen again. I really
it's
do.
True. And they're mostly competent, all of them.
This has been incredibly wonderful to spend this time with you, Jen.
It's been lovely to spend this time with you.
Thank you, Tova.
Post Googa Mooga. Thank
you,
Tova.
Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.